I'm VOA's Joe Ramsey with your worldwide news update. Firefighters scrambled Sunday to make progress against wildfires that have killed at least 16 people in the Los Angeles area as forecasters again warned of dangerous weather with the return of strong winds this week. At least 16 people are missing, and authorities say that number is expected to rise. The California Office of Emergency Services says 150,000 people in Los Angeles County are under evacuation orders, with more than 700 people taking refuge in 9 shelters. The U.S. National Weather Service has issued red flag warnings for severe fire conditions through Wednesday, with sustained winds of 80 kilometers per hour and gusts in the mountains topping 100 kilometers per hour. The Weather Service says the most dangerous day will be Tuesday, warning about the combination of gusty winds, a dry atmosphere, and dry brush. Fierce winds have been largely blamed for turning wildfires sparked last week into infernos that leveled entire neighborhoods around the city where there has been no significant rainfall in more than 8 months. AP correspondent Julie Walker has more.
County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney says while they have made progress fighting the blazes,
these winds combined with low relative humidities and low fuel moistures will keep the fire threat in Los Angeles County very high.
But he says they are prepared.
Reports that I've received is that the LA County water system is ready.
LA Police Chief Jim McDonald says they can no longer allow residents back into burned out areas because of the dangers and the search for the missing.
We will have cadaver dog deployment, and that will result in crime scene preservation.
I'm Julie Walker.
This is VOA News. Experts and rights advocates are reacting to the United States' determination that genocide is being committed by Sudan's Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group and its allies. Reporter Henry Wilkins has more.
Adam Rojal is with the General Coordination of Darfur Displaced People and Refugees.
The community in Darfur is well aware of the crimes and violations committed against them. They consider these acts of genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity to be a natural part of their lives. For them, the recognition and acknowledgement by the international community and larger countries is a victory and a step towards achieving justice.
Nicole Windersheim, a deputy director at Human Rights Watch.
They can feel that their trauma is recognized. I mean, I don't want to understate that.
When asked for a response to the accusations, an RSF spokesperson provided VOA with a statement widely shared on social media. It said, "This decision has no value or impact on the current situation in Sudan, but may complicate the Sudanese crisis. The statement does not deny the allegation of genocide." Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
The White House says U.S. President Joe Biden and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke Sunday about the latest efforts to reach a ceasefire and hostage release in the Israel-Hamas war. The phone call is part of an intensifying push to reach a deal before Donald Trump's inauguration next week. Talks mediated over the past year by the United States, Egypt, and Qatar have repeatedly stalled at moments when they seemed close to a deal. Still, in recent days, U.S. officials have expressed hope of sealing an agreement. The head of Israel's Mossad Foreign Intelligence Agency and Biden's top Mideast advisor are both in the Qatari capital Doha, which has been helping mediate talks. The European Union's foreign policy chief says the bloc's foreign ministers will discuss easing sanctions imposed on Syria at a meeting in Brussels later this month.
We want to see no radicalization. We want to see inclusiveness of women also in the process. So these are the things that we are going to discuss.
Kaya Kallas's comments came at a gathering of top European and Middle Eastern diplomats Sunday in the Saudi capital of Riyadh to discuss Syria's future after the overthrow of President Bashar al-Assad last month. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website, voanews.com. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, January 13th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Voters in the Comoros Island await results from Sunday's parliamentary elections.
The opposition has been divided. You had parties not participating, but you have also, you know, some political figures who took part in this election.
The U.S. declaration of genocide in Darfur is seen as a victory in Sudan. Ethiopian Prime Minister and Somali President met in Addis Ababa over the weekend. Malawi's DPP accuses the police of an alleged shooting that wounded a female opposition official. Mozambique's opposition presidential candidate called for 3 days of protest and a national strike ahead of President-elect's inauguration.
Remember, he doesn't acknowledge the results. He doesn't acknowledge Chapo as the president. So I guess what he's doing is consistent with his call for the nullification of these results.
And American voters look ahead to a new Trump term. Those stories and Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Voters in the Comoros Islands are expecting results from Sunday's parliamentary elections. Some opposition members had said they would boycott the polls because of President Azali Assoumani's authoritarian rule. Sai Machangama is the CEO and the chief editor of Heba FM Radio in Moroni. He tells me that from his viewpoint, the election went smoothly and peacefully.
The election went, I would say, peacefully. There has, to my knowledge, no violence recorded. In some places, it has been reported that armies have expelled, you know, election officials who were representative of the opposition. But so far, things went peacefully. And now, of course, from the opposition side, they have been denouncing irregularities, you know, of people coming with vote, you know, bulletins, several of them, you know, already, you know, checked for the ruling party's candidates.
The opposition has said that it would not take part in the parliamentary election because of what happened in last year's presidential election. Did the opposition participate?
Well, the opposition has been divided. You know, you had parties not participating, but you have also, you know, some political figures of national stature and parties like Orange, RDCP, who took part or participated in the in this election.
One concern that some members of the opposition have expressed is the idea that President Azali Assoumani may be trying to groom his son to succeed him.
Well, that is a shared view by opposition, not only opposition, but a big part of the population. Of course, Azali's son is, in, you know, is a politician, and as a politician, he's ambitious, and it wouldn't be a wonder if he wanted to succeed his father. Now, of course, the view here is that he is candidate because his father is thinking of changing the situation. So through parliament, the son could be prepared, groomed to succeed him.
Sai Machangama is the CEO and the chief editor of Heba FM Radio in Moroni, Comoros Islands. Mozambique's opposition presidential candidate, Venancio Mondlane, has called for 3 days of protest and a national strike this week. This comes as the country's newly elected parliament is set to sit today, Monday, and the inauguration of President-elect Daniel Chapo is scheduled for this Wednesday. Adriano Nuvunga is the chair of the Mozambique Human Rights Defenders Network. He tells me that the protest call is consistent with Mulani's demand for the nullification of the election results.
I think he aims at, number one, to make sure that the event which will take place, it is not a shining event. So the objective is to reduce the impact, reduce the visibility of the event, and also reduce the beauty of the event. Number two is to make the pressure that he has been making, the pressure for him to be part of the post-inauguration politics and governance. And thirdly, the way I view it, is for him to consolidate himself as the opposition leader in Mozambique.
As you said, the event, Daniel Chapo, is to be inaugurated on, I think, this Wednesday, the 15th. So how can Mr. Moulin call for a protest when the president is going to be inaugurated? Is he not concerned about the possibility of violence?
I think he is. Everybody is. We are all concerned that there might be violence. Of course, about 500 people have been thus far killed in the country, and we fear that more lives can be lost. People are being targeted everywhere. But, you know, politicians, they push to the extreme for their objectives. That's how I see Mr. Mondan doing. Remember, he doesn't acknowledge the results. He doesn't acknowledge Chapo as the president. So I guess what he's doing is consistent with his call for the nullification of these results.
President-elect Chapo has been quoted as saying that he did not invite Mr. Moulin to participate in the meeting that Mr. Chapo had with political leaders because, according to Chapo, Moulin does not officially represent any political party. Do you think Mr. Moulin would have loved to participate if he had been invited?
Well, you invite and then see what the person will do. You don't give justification before inviting the person. So I think Mr. Sharp should have invited him and see how Mondano would react to that. You invite the Renam leader, you invite the MDM, you invite Nova Democracia and others. They are not acknowledged by the people. It is Mondano who has, at the moment, the ability to call shots on what happens or does not happen.
Mozambique Human Rights Defenders Network, he spoke with me from the Mozambican capital, Maputo. Experts and rights advocates are reacting to the United States' determination on Tuesday, January 7th, that genocide is being committed, Sudan's Rapid Support Forces and its allies. Reporter Henry Wilkins has more.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in a January 7th statement that Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces, RSF, and allied militias have systemically murdered men and boys, even infants, on an ethnic basis, determining that crimes committed by RSF and its allies amount to genocide. The leaders of a Darfuri advocacy group reacted to the news. Adam Rojal is with the General Coordination of Darfur Displaced People and Refugees.
The community in Darfur is well aware of the crimes and violations committed against them. They consider these acts of genocide, ethnic cleansing, war crimes, and crimes against humanity to be a natural part of their lives. For them, the recognition and acknowledgement by the international community and larger countries is a victory and a step towards achieving justice.
The RSF and its associated militias are mostly ethnic Arabs, victimizing black Sudanese, particularly the ethnic Masalit people. The declaration is a first step towards justice, say rights groups. Nicole Windersheim, a deputy director at Human Rights Watch.
They can feel that their trauma is recognized. I mean, I don't want to understate that.
Blinken also announced sanctions against RSF's leader and businesses linked to the paramilitary group. Windersheim says this is the second time in 20 years that genocide has been declared in Darfur.
Lessons unlearned and not enough preventative action.
Many consider genocide to be the most serious crime under international law. Cameron Hudson of the Center for Strategic and International Studies says the legal implications a significant.
Significant from a legal perspective, but I think also from a moral perspective.
Blinken singled out RSF commander Mohammed Hamdan Daglo for violating commitments under international law to protect Sudanese civilians. One leader accused in the 2004 genocide in Darfur is still on trial at the International Criminal Court. Meanwhile, Rojal says ethnic killings continue and that ongoing fighting in parts of Darfur has led to famine.
Direct killing inside the camps, in the cities and neighborhoods, and starvation, famine, and hunger, these all continue.
When asked for a response to the accusations, an RSF spokesperson provided VOA with a statement widely shared on social media. It said, "This decision has no value or impact on the current situation in Sudan, but may complicate the Sudanese crisis. The statement does not deny the allegation of genocide." Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barkey in Washington. Today's Monday, January 13. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed and Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamed met in Addis Ababa over the weekend. The meeting comes after Turkey mediated talks to resolve disputes between the two countries, including Ethiopia's need to gain access to the Red Sea. Somali political analyst Faisal Abdi Roble tells me that Somalia may agree to give Ethiopia access to the sea, but only for commercial purposes.
This visit speaks to the Ankara Declaration, which called for normalization of the diplomatic relationship between the two. I think that triggered a visit by a Somali delegation sometime early January to Addis, and then that was repaid. Also, equal visit was made by Ethiopian Defense Minister and Deputy Foreign Minister to Bishop. This is the second round where Hassan Sheikh Mohamed visited on a special invitation by Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. And there is a talk that Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed will be coming to Mogadishu. So this is dialing down the temperature and normalizing the diplomatic relationship between the two countries.
So when we spoke briefly before, you indicated that the current trio of Hassan Sheikh is not about sea access, but to talk about the African Union forces?
Yes, the subject matter of this visit will cover the talks around the normalization of the diplomacy of the two and also Ethiopia's participation as a new restructured the awesome peacekeeping mission, which initially Somalia excluded Ethiopia, but after the Ankara, when the relationship became normal, Somalia agreed to include Ethiopia, especially since Burundi left the mission. And they talked about the numbers, which do not exceed 3,000 Ethiopian troops, and where they will be stationed. Somalia does not want Ethiopian forces to be stationed where they used to be, which is Jubaland, because there is a notion and understanding by Somalia that Ethiopia has interfered in the political arena of Somalia.
So talk to us about the visit of the Somali foreign minister to Cairo. What is happening there?
So as you recall, James, there was a strategic alliance between Eritrea, Egypt, and Somalia, mainly on ensuring that although each one has its own interests, the big picture was protecting Somalia's territorial integrity at the time when Ethiopia was really a sort of a threat to Somalia. So that strategic alliance has not changed. The talks in Cairo this week between the trio is to ensure that although Somalia is normalizing its relationship with Ethiopia, it at the same time stands by Egypt and Eritrea on that strategic alliance, which, as they put, is not really creating the enemy out of Ethiopia, but helping Somalia to maintain its peace and security in the face of serious threats. But also, the elephant of the house is these two countries and others did not want Ethiopia to annex, or at least to go by the MOU that Ethiopia signed with the breakaway state of Somaliland last year, January 1, 2024.
Faisal Abdi Roble is a Somali analyst. He was speaking with us from Los Angeles, California. In Malawi, the opposition Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP, is accusing the police of an alleged shooting on Saturday in Lilongwe that wounded Brenda Saidi, a female official. Mary Tom Nandisha is the national director of women for the opposition DPP. She tells me that the ruling Malawi Congress Party has resorted to violence and intimidation against women who oppose its agenda ahead of the 2025 presidential election.
We thank God that the injury is not life-threatening, but nevertheless, it was as serious as there was tissue damage just above the right elbow. She has also experienced severe pain, and currently she's been admitted at Christ Hospital, but she's getting better.
Who does your party suspect for carrying out this alleged shooting? I mean, I'm saying alleged because we're not sure.
So far, the police are yet to disclose as to who was responsible. We are yet to get any credible statement from the police as regards to this incident. Apart from saying that they are investigating the matter, and the sad part of it is that sometimes the investigations never come to conclusion as they tend to have natural death. So we are just waiting.
So what makes you to believe that you think the police are responsible? Because as you said, the police themselves say they have instituted an investigation about the alleged shooting.
You may wish to know that Malawians who have general elections this coming September, and so far, all credible opinion polls indicate that ruling party has no chance of free election. In view of that, it has resulted to arresting leading and as I'm speaking, our vice president from the central region, Honorable Alfred Gangata, is in custody. Now, some of our supporters, including Mrs. Brenda Saidi, went to see and cheer him up. But this did not please the police, who tried to dislodge them. And in the process, we believe they opened fire on her. And we have confidence that the police are the one responsible. And the party, we are very, very concerned.
Mary Tom Navicha is the National Director of Women for the Opposition Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP. She was speaking with me from Blantyre. Amnesty International says renowned Tanzanian rights activist Maria Sirungi Sehai was kidnapped on the streets of the Kenyan capital Nairobi on Sunday. According to the French news agency, Sehai campaigns for political change, freedom of expression, and women's rights in Tanzania and has 1.3 million followers on X. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Monday morning to you, Samson.
Good Monday morning to you too, James. We begin the sports package with match day 5 of the CAF Champions League's group stage. We saw 5 teams join already qualified Al Hilal in securing quarterfinal spots for the Premier Continental competition. As far, Pyramids FC, Esperance Dutsinis, Al Hakli, and Orlando Pirates have put their names alongside the Sudanese club to see 6 of the 8 slots in the next round confirmed. In Group A, MC Alger took a major step towards qualification when they defeated DR Congo's TP Mazembe 1-0 in Algiers on Friday night, courtesy of Akram Bosa's first-half penalty. The Algerian club could have been confirmed quarterfinalist had leaders Al Hilal not suffered a 1-0 home loss to Tanzania's Young Africans in Nouakchott on Sunday night. Group B leaders as far confirmed progression on Saturday night when they were held 1-1 at home by fellow Moroccan club Raja Casablanca. As far likely to be joined in the last 8 by South African champions Mamelodi Sundowns, who claimed a much-needed 2-1 away win over DR Congo's AS Maimena Union in Kinshasa on Saturday afternoon. Sundowns will only need a draw in their final match at home home to as far next Sunday to guarantee a quarterfinal ticket. Group C is all wrapped up after Orlando Pirates and Al Ahly both claimed victories to secure qualification. The Egyptian heavyweights came from a goal down to defeat Stade Abidjan 3-1 in Ivory Coast on Saturday before the South Africans reclaimed top spot with a 2-1 home triumph over Algeria's CR Belouizdad on Sunday. Pyramids FC of Egypt and Tunisia's Esperance did the same thing in Group D, securing wins to lock out the top two places and guarantee advancement. Pyramids thumped Sagrada Esperanca 1-0 in Angola on Saturday, while Esperance edged Mali's Juliba 1-0 in Bamako on Sunday. The Champions League group stage will conclude next weekend with 8 matches across Saturday, the 18th and Sunday, the 19th of January. In athletics, Ethiopians secured the top 10 positions in both male and female categories at the Dubai Marathon on Sunday as their athletes dominated the leaderboard. Bud Gemertu secured the men's title with a time of 2 hours, 4 minutes, 51 seconds. The 23-year-old newcomer has only competed in a handful of international races so far. Meanwhile, in a dramatic women's finish, Bedatu Hepea overtook fellow Ethiopian Dera Dida on the finishing straight and won in a world lead of 2 hours, 18 minutes, 27 seconds, while the 35-year-old celebrated her biggest career win and a huge personal best. Dida looked devastated when she crossed the line 4 seconds behind in 2 hours, 18 minutes, 31 seconds. And that's it for this Monday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a very good Monday. And that's it for this Monday, January 13th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for beginning your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing that you will have a great week.